You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2018 and October 2018 issues of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of the final article for the September 2018 issue, Muse Without a Trace, by Brian Moynihan. John Galliano devoted his 2011 spring and summer collection to Marielani, the heroic con artist. I was inspired when I heard how she had vanished with 50 of the most wonderful canvases and was never seen again, he said. I thought, oh my God, she's such a Galliano girl. Next, artwork by Henri Matisse, Aquatint in black, on wove paper, 1928, and by Chaim Soutain, oil, on canvas, 1929. I first came across the story of Marielani years ago as a Paris correspondent for the London Sunday Times. Something about it wasn't quite right. If it was all super chérie, the lovely-sounding French word that hints at super darling, but means brutally fraud and deception, then this must surely have been the greatest scam in the scam-ridden history of fine art. How, then, could it be so obscure? The artists involved are world-class names, but who really were Lani and Abramowitz? The plain details of Lani's life, as known to the artist of Paris in the 1920s, were predictably false. She was not who she said she was. She was, in fact, born Maria Jelenevich. She was raised in the Jewish quarter of Czestochowa, a city in southern Poland, the daughter of Roman Jelenevich, a factory worker, and his wife, Eve. She took 10 years off her age when she gave her birth, her date of birth, as June 24, 1905, to French officials. She may well have trained as an actress in Berlin with Max Reinhardt, as she and her accomplice claimed. But her name is not on any Reinhardt cast list, nor is any appearance on the Paris stage or screen recorded. Abramovich, meanwhile, was not her impresario. He was her Russian-born husband. By some accounts, Marielani's brother was also in on the act. It also turns out that Lani and Abramowitz didn't leave Paris in 1931. Instead, the stories in the press had simply dried up. There were no new paintings to write about. For the most part, the artist didn't see the couple anymore, although Cocteau still had occasional dealings with them. No film was made. The city had become avant-garde. Pre the next war, gray, nervous, unstable. Indeed, the childless couple were still there when the Germans came. On May 31st, 1940, as the panzers closed in, Lani telegraphed Lisbon from Paris to ask for a Portuguese visa. There was no reply. A single lifeline remained open. In defiance of orders, Aristides de Souza Mendes, the Portuguese consul in Bordeaux, was still issuing visas to refugees, Russians and Jews in particular. I would rather stand with God and against man, he said, than with man against God. Souza Mendes followed his conscience, and he was to pay for it with bankruptcy and the loss of his ancestral home. But he saved Lani and Abramowitz. The Nazis were snapping at their heels when he gave them visas at the end of June. They crossed the French border into Spain and traveled on to Lisbon. They sailed for New York on the Excambion in March 1941. Just as Salvador and Gala Dalí, also bearing Sousa Mendes visas, had done the previous August. Lani and Abramowitz left just in time. As foreign-born Jews, they had been at maximum risk as soon as the Nazis entered Paris in June of 1940. Moreover, they had known Chaim Soutain, a Frenchman with Jewish roots in Russia and Lithuania. A single Soutain painting had been exhibited in pre-war Germany, his portrait of Marie Lani. Some have posited that this painting and rising Soutain prices whetted the interest of Hermann Göring, the Third Reich's plunderer-in-chief. The Gestapo headquarters on the Avenue Falck in Paris were ordered to use all means to seize the artist, his paintings, and his circle. Alvéque des Juden Soutain, all the Jews' works, were to be sent to Berlin immediately. Soutain was on the run and ill, sleeping in Forest. Only 50 years old, he died of a perforated ulcer in August of 1943, before the Gestapo ever found him. Lani and Abramowitz fared better. In fact, they flourished. Safety in New York brought the couple fresh vigor. The scenario for The Woman with the 100 Faces was finally written in 1943. It transferred from paint to word the drama of Lani and her portraits that had so captivated Paris. And what words! Abramowitz, writing as Maximilian Ilyin, brought in two collaborators he had met in Paris in the 20s. They were as fabulous as the painters. Thomas Mann, one of the greatest writers of the century, already a Nobel Prize winner, was one. His work, Death in Venice, say, or The Magic Mountain, slipped easily into film. Louis Bromfield was the other. He had been nominated to the Vanity Fair Hall of Fame in 1927, the year he won a Pulitzer Prize. Fine films, The Rains Came, Mrs. Parkington, were made from his best-selling novels. In their scenario, Mann, Bromfield, and Abramowitz, Ilyin, wrote of the City of Light and of characters named after themselves, meeting up again in New York during the war. Lani was busy, too. She was working for the Stage Door Canteen in Manhattan, a charity where actresses wearing red, white, and blue aprons and other unpaid volunteers helped lonely servicemen in the big city. Lauren Bacall danced the jitterbug, and Helen Hayes served sandwiches. In December 1945, Life ran a piece praising Lani's efforts. Her fluent command of French, Polish, German, Portuguese, and Russian, as well as English, was in demand with foreign allies. She plans to stay in the U.S. Her life is the basis for a motion picture scenario, and she hopes someday to play on Broadway. The Life piece mentioned the multiple portraits, crediting Matisse with the idea. Unlikely, since Cocteau was the first to draw her, but it had a nice ring to it. After 13 years of living virtually underground, Lani was back in the public eye. At last, all seemed set for the movie. Luella Parsons, the doyenne of Hollywood gossip, told her readers on August 2, 1947, that three giants of letters had united to write The Woman of the 100 Faces. It was, she reported, a dramatic story about a famous European model painted by 100 artists. The three authors actually knew the woman. The screen rights were bought by the producers Boris Maros, who happened to be an FBI double agent, and William LeBaron. Greta Garbo was to star. Hedda Hopper, arch-rival of Parsons, retaliated on August 28th. She tapped Hedy Lamarr for the lead. In the end, it was not to be. The film was never made, and Abramowitz carried on, taking what work he could as a screenwriter. Occasional credits survive. For additional dialogue in a film noir called Gunmen in the Streets, for a TV adaptation of a Cocteau stage play. It did not bring in enough to live on, and so at some point in the early 50s, they returned to Paris. Lani became ill in early 1954. Her first admission to the Pitié-Salpêtrière Hospital that January gave her married name as Ilian and her maiden name as Maria Lani. It gave her nationality as American, though no other document confirms that she ever took U.S. citizenship. She was later readmitted and died of a brain tumor on March 11, 1954, at age 58. The obituaries were brief. One caught Cocteau's eye as he traveled to the Cannes Film Festival. "She is dead," he wrote in his diary. The weather was foul, he noted, with wind and heavy rain. It matched his mood. He had fallen out with Abramowitz, now calling himself Ilian, over an agreement they had made in 1935 for the foreign rights to Cocteau's play Le Voix Humaine. "He bilked me of the rights," he noted sourly. When he got to Cannes, he cheered himself up by taking in the premiere of Fred Zinnemann's From Here to Eternity, based on the heralded World War II novel by James Jones. The widowed Abramowitz fared badly. He wrote a couple of artist biographies under the Ilian name. They did not sell well. Partisan Review included his translation of Le Voix Humaine in a paperback collection of pieces from the magazine. It paid a royalty to Cocteau's French publishers. Abramowitz sued the magazine to get his share. To do this, he needed Cocteau as a witness, but Cocteau wanted nothing to do with it. The case was heard in New York in July 1956. The court ruled that Cocteau was an indispensable party to it. No action could be taken in his absence. Case dismissed. The royalty that so fretted Abramowitz totaled $70.40. Abramowitz eked out a living as an art critic, dividing his time between the south of France and his beloved Paris, where he died at 71 in 1964. His publisher folded. None of his papers or letters are believed to have survived. In the screenplay scenario that Abramowitz wrote with Mann and Bromfield, 100 Maria Lani paintings are exhibited together in a gallery. New York's smart set is at the opening, writers and painters, with a sprinkling of refugees and international white trash. The crowd begins to thin. Abramowitz, Mann, and Bromfield, who wrote themselves into the script, sit on the upholstered benches in the gallery. They half notice an elderly woman who lingers, peering at the portraits through a gold lorgnette. She is dowdy, wrinkled, but she has eyes as translucent as mother of pearl, and her mouth is rouged, monstrous and magnificent. She is smoking through a gold cigarette holder of impertinently extreme length, and the shoulder of her greenish-black silk dress is slipped far down. She is the woman in the pictures, here called Hortense Pichat. Painters know her as L'Insatiable, the elusive. The real-life Maria Lani was certainly elusive, and remains so in memory. Occasionally she comes up in a magazine article or an exhibition. But one thing remains certain. The paintings, some 58 of them, given that some artists painted her several times, along with a dozen photographs and a half dozen sculptures, exist. They hang in great museums, and they appear at auction from time to time. They are real. Abramovitz and Lani never had a golden hoard of artwork. Neither did the Marialani's flood onto the market. Some were retained by the artist and their families, while others were sold by dealers and galleries over the years. The Robert Delaunay portrait, for example, remained in the collection of his wife, the painter Sonia Delaunay, until her death in 1979, before Sotheby's eventually sold it for $250,000 in 2011. A Ruart portrait was bought by the Arts Club of Chicago after its 1929 Marialani exhibition and presented as a gift to the Art Institute of Chicago in 1932. Despiau's magnificent bronze head of Marialani with eyes open resides at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The Soutain, perhaps the best-known Marialani, was sold by the Bernheim-Jeune Gallery in Paris in 1932, to Lucien de Motte, who had galleries in Paris and New York, and was sold on to the financier and collector, Sam A. Lewison. His widow bequeathed it to the Museum of Modern Art in 1954. Another Soutain portrait, Le Petit Pâtissier, fetched $18 million at Christie's in 2013. Most of the Marialani pieces are accounted for. The series that Matisse did turned out to be as evanescent as Lani's own strange, fleeting bout with fame. As Matisse sat in a Parisian café with Lani and Abramovitz one day in 1929, the artist sketched four drawings of her on the marble tabletop. A waiter came by and wiped them all away with a dirty cloth. The author of this story, Brian Moynihan, the noted author, foreign correspondent, and editor, passed away in April at age 77. Thank you. Now, on to the October 2018 issue of Vanity Fair, which features Felicity Jones on the cover. Here's the Vanity Fair agenda, promotion, events. Visit Bold Boutique Bisha. Meet Bisha, the new luxury boutique hotel found in the heart of Toronto's entertainment district. Unabashedly original, the hotel's piercing 44 stories are home to 96 luxury rooms and suites, private residences, and some of the country's most sought-after restaurants. Curated for the creative soul, guests are enticed to indulge in a true Bisha experience, from the Luxe Lobby, Mr. C Lounge, French Maid Cafe, Akira Back, rooftop restaurant Cost, with unparalleled city skyline views, to your overnight oasis. Luxuriate your senses. Read These Truths by Jill Lepore. The award-winning historian and New Yorker writer crafts the most ambitious one-volume history of the United States in decades, tracing the intertwined histories of politics, law, journalism, and technology, from the colonial town meeting to Facebook news. Walter Isaacson says it's inspiring and enlightening, adding that Jill Lepore accomplishes the grand task of telling us what we need to know about our past in order to be good citizens today. And Henry Louis Gates, Jr. calls it an epic work, with which Lepore reaffirms her place as one of the truly great historians of our time. Event: Ralph Lauren Fragrances celebrates Polo Red Rush. Ralph Lauren Fragrances hosted a party to celebrate the new face of Polo Red, actor and musician Ansel Elgort. The event also marked the launch of the franchise's new fragrance, Polo Red Rush. Performances by Catronata and DJ Brendan Fallis set the tone as the crowd entered the world of Polo Red Rush, which is inspired by the adrenaline of cars and music. The space included a fragrance experience, large-scale video projections, and several vintage automobiles, all set to views of the Hudson River. Guests included Ansel Elgort, actor and musician, Alana Arrington, model, Quincy Combs, actor, and Winnie Harlow, model. Now for some of the contributors to this month's issue. Irene Carman, The Justice and Ms. Jones. Carman says she loved nerding out about The Justice with Felicity Jones, who plays Ruth Bader Ginsburg in On the Basis of Sex. Carman's wedding last year was officiated by Ginsburg and an exhibition adapted from her book Notorious RBG opens in October at the Skirball Cultural Center in Los Angeles. Joy Press, just FYI. When the Vanity Fair TV correspondent interviewed Murphy Brown creator Diane English for her 2015 book about women in television, neither expected that Murphy would soon return to primetime. It was amazing, Press says, to check in with English and her crusading alter ego. Dave Cullen, The Parkland Ground Game. While spending 10 years writing Columbine, Cullen says he suffered secondary PTSD and swore he'd never return to a mass shooting's immediate aftermath. But the Parkland kids amazed me, he says. Cullen's next book, Parkland, will be published by HarperCollins in February. Sam Tannenhaus, Hostile Takeover. Tannenhaus, who is working on a biography of William F. Buckley, Jr., has written extensively on American conservative politics. The highlight of his reporting on the DeVos clan's Midwestern roots, he says, was getting a tour of author Russell Kirk's famous library in Mecosta, Michigan. Adam Leith-Gulner, Dead End on Highway 1. Investigating unsolved murders in the Mississippi Delta was as unsettling as it was fulfilling, says Gulner, the author of The Fruit Hunters and The Book of Immortality, and the former editor-in-chief of Vice. Whenever I would dig deeper, I kept finding clues. For October 2018, here's the editor's letter from Redica Jones, editor. In the photo, Felicity Jones and photographer Mark Seliger outside Columbia University's Lowe Memorial Library, New York City. Early in the film, On the Basis of Sex, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg's husband and fellow Harvard Law student, Marty, is diagnosed with testicular cancer, Ruth comes up with a plan to keep him on track to graduate. She begins attending his classes in addition to her own, racing from lecture to lecture, like Hermione Granger without a time-turner. She is one of only 9 women in her class of more than 500, and the juggling act she masters at that time in her life, law student by day, mother, wife, and spousal teaching assistant by night, is an almost comically impressive performance of work-life balance. Not that it helps her get a job. As we see in a series of powerful and infuriating scenes, no law firm in New York City wanted to hire a female lawyer in 1959. Because, among other things, she might make the partner's wives nervous. Watching Felicity Jones play the young Ruth Bader Ginsburg, watching her graduate first in her class, and be turned down by prestigious law firm after prestigious law firm, you realize just how profoundly unfair the world could be to even the most accomplished of women before Ruth Bader Ginsburg came along to fix it. This fall marks Justice Ginsburg's 25th year serving on the Supreme Court. The first full-length biography of her, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, A Life, written by Jane Sharon DeHart, with the justices' cooperation, will be published in October. A documentary, RBG, was released earlier this year to remarkable box office success. Only Mr. Rogers has out-earned her in theaters, and will air on CNN in early September. Our cover story is written by Erin Carman, who already wrote the book on Ginsburg, the best-selling notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which she co-authored with Shana Gnixnik. Mark Seliger photographed Felicity Jones in July at Columbia University, Justice Ginsburg's alma mater. She transferred there to complete her degree after Marty got a job in New York. That day, the Supreme Court was very much on our minds. A few weeks before our shoot, Justice Anthony Kennedy had announced his retirement, freeing up a second seat for the Trump administration to fill, though it's only the first seat to open since his inauguration. A few days after our shoot, Ginsburg made headlines when she told CNN she'd be sticking around for another 5 years until she's 90. One of the most inspiring aspects of Justice Ginsburg's life, especially to those of us who neglected to be child prodigies, is that she became an icon so late in it. She has her trademark style, the lace gloves, the statement earrings, the power collars. But it's layered on top of decades of substance, namely a series of cases carefully chosen to establish the burdens of gender discrimination and a legal path toward correcting them. On the Basis of Sex shows us RBG before she became notorious RBG, though I suspect that Felicity Jones's portrayal will become iconic in its own right, the strategic and passionate youthful counterpart of the dissenting, opera-loving octogenarian we know and love to watch lift weights. Speaking of style and substance, in this issue we are delighted to present our annual Best Dressed list with a focus on creativity and personal expression. Wear what you want, says one of our honorees, the actor Lakeith Stanfield. It's not a competition. Still, he's winning at it, as are LeBron James, king of the short suit, Meghan Markle, Duchess of the Boat Neck, and Timothée Chalamet, Master of Monochrome. Maybe it's not a competition, but our 43 style icons will inspire you to get in the game. For this month's correspondence, Vanity Fair uses an illustration by Braulio Amado, which features a green snake which has swallowed a reader holding up a book, and the snake is reading a copy of Vanity Fair. This quote from Jack Hanley, nothing but sincerity as far as the eye can see. Worldwide worry. From Dublin, Ireland, Brendan Kelly writes, your story about Tim Berners-Lee's call to arms to save the Internet, I was devastated by Katrina Brooker, August, brought to mind a comment made by journalist Bernard Levin some 40 years ago in the Times, October 3, 1978. The silicon chip will transform everything, except everything that matters, and the rest will still be up to us. Ah, barricade. Tom Dargan from New Rochelle, New York writes, we see that web inventor Sir Tim Berners-Lee hopes to save us by inventing a new decentralized web that protects our privacy. But why not save ourselves with a new law? This law would simply extend the privacy we all expect of letters, phone calls, telegrams, and faxes to the datagrams of the Internet. These Internet Protocol Packet datagrams, or IP packets for short, are the basis of the Internet. The web relies on them to communicate. Each is unique, like a letter. Each has a return address, a personal to address, and a message, voice, video, or data, inside, like a letter. Believe it or not, there is no law preventing the carrier you pay, Verizon, AT&T, or cable companies, from opening, reading, copying, and selling your personal datagrams. Congresspersons and state legislators, it is time for that law. Jack Hanley writes from Abington, Massachusetts, this was a sad tale of woe about someone smart enough to know better. I wish the writer would have asked him why he didn't stop to ask, is this the right thing to do, before unleashing the web on the world without fully knowing its consequences? And after his new version of the Internet arrives, how will the original web that we're all using now be shut off? How do we get our data back from the tech giants after we've all had to hit agree buttons for everything we use? The whole story rings of Linus insisting that his next pumpkin patch will be even more sincere next year. Nothing but sincerity as far as the eye can see. 30 years ago, and this photograph by Giuseppe Pino from October 1988 of Bill Blass, fashion eminence, wrote Nicholas Coleridge, the shiny set is exceptionally loyal to Blass. When they describe him, it is in similar terms to those reserved by 19th century hostesses for society, sculptors, and watercolorists. Said socialite Judy Peabody, he is a Cole Porter song. From At Bethanyo, Kendrick Ascendant by Lisa Robinson, August, his exact words are kept in many places, letting it breathe. He's so eloquent. So that was deaf, the move. At I Am Daniel Guerra, never had a full understanding of Kendrick's importance to black hip-hop culture. This piece reveals it and goes further by confirming his acceptance of what is viewed by many as a heavy responsibility, essential reading. Coming soon from our contributors, Saudi America by Bethany McLean, Columbia Global Reports, 9/12. Studio 54, a documentary by Matt Tiernauer, 10/5. A Private War by Marie Brenner, Simon & Schuster, 10/9. from the vanities on beauty, Paris Mode. Forthright feminist Maria Grazia Chiuri, Italian-born artistic director of the quintessentially French house of Christian Dior, chronicles the products and places that prepare her for Fashion Week. Stroll along Ile Saint-Louis, Saint-Germain, Place Saint-Sulpice to be alone, Jardin du Luxembourg to work out, Studio Rituel for a facial, Plaza Athénée Spa. Show day wake up, 9 a.m. We typically work late the night before to finish up the fittings, so I try to get as much sleep as I can in order to re-energize before the show. Bath or shower? Shower. With Evne Gel, shampoo and conditioner, Shu Amira Ultimate Remedy, body lotion, Clarins Balm Core, face wash, Dior Hydra Life. Eyeshadow Couleur in Black, Dior 5, toothpaste, Marvis Classic Strong Mint. Fragrance, Dior Eau Sauvage or Clarins Eau d'Innocente. Home scent, Trudon and Nersto. Nail polish, Chanel Rouge Noir. Show day ritual, I'll eat breakfast with my daughter if she is in town, and then Laura, my makeup artist, does my makeup while I reply to emails on my phone. Current inspirations by the movies of Fellini, Visconti, Antonioni are a permanent reference. Contemporary art and artists such as Tracy Emin, Graciela Iturbide, Louise Bourgeois, and Yayoi Kusama. Feminism means being able to walk through the world without being discriminated against. It's about moving from a patriarchal definition of femininity to one that is more realistic, where strength and the female lived experience are compatible and can coexist without needing to be mutually exclusive. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.